the course of this study, I've had several people come up to me, and I take it as a great compliment because they've commented on how they may not understand everything in Revelation, but they get the main idea, and they aren't scared of it or intimidated by it anymore. And that's awesome, because I feel like that's about where I am in teaching the class as well. I don't understand everything in Revelation, but I know the main idea, and I'm not intimidated by it. On the contrary, I think all of us should love a study of the book of Revelation because of what it provides to us. It is accomplishing what God desires for it to accomplish in me, and I hope in you as well. So that's where I want us to begin as we restart our study here in this book. What is our purpose here? What is it that God is trying to accomplish in the book of Revelation? I say three main purposes. You can add some additional purposes to this. But if we're really boiling it down, what is it that God is trying to accomplish? I'll have some things on the screen, but what do you think? In our study so far, what is it that God is trying to accomplish? Contrary to what a lot of people take out of the book of Revelation, I would add. Yes. Okay, that he is victorious in the end. And really, that's a good way of summing up what the theme of Revelation is, the victoriousness of God. God is going to win. And if we're on his side, we're going to win too. Okay, what else? What is his purpose for these people that he's trying to accomplish? Encouragement. I think that's a huge one, to give them encouragement. Why? Why do they need to be encouraged? Hard times are coming. They've already started a little bit, and it's about to get a whole lot worse, and you're going to need some encouragement during those times. What else would you say would be important here? In times when hard times come, you need to be encouraged, but is that the only thing that you need? If you're going to face hard times and understand those things, you need to have the right what? The right faith, the right perspective. That's exactly right. You need to see these things and have some hope beyond these things in that encouragement. And you've really hit upon what I believe are the three main purposes here. Number one, to give God's people the proper perspective and hope in an impactful and powerful way. They needed something that would be easily remembered, that they could hang on to in those moments of intense persecution. Well, we need something to hang on to too, don't we? In those times when we face trials and persecution, something to remember, something to give us perspective and hope. I believe the book of Revelation does that for us as we see it played out in the spiritual realm on a grand scale, and to give God's people encouragement in these times. In general, people get pretty caught up in trying to look for specific fulfillments for all of these things. Historical events, either past or future, for the trumpets and the seals. But I don't think that's really the main point. Now, there's certainly some of that. We think back to chapter 1 and verse 20. He says, the seven lampstands are what? They are the seven churches. Well, there's a specific application to those symbols there, right? He's telling you there's a literal thing that you need to be looking for, these seven churches in Asia. And we see that in a number of places throughout the book. In Revelation 17 and verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. In verse 18 of the same chapter, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. I think we need to sit up and listen when he says, now this is that. When he gives us an interpretation, we need to say, okay, what is it that he's talking about in a more literal sense? That does happen. And folks in this time, the Christians in this time, they would have recognized those things even better than we. But that's not the main point of the book of Revelation, to have these very specific literal interpretations. The point is this, and I've said this a couple of times. God is going to judge the wicked and preserve the righteous through the trials. Not from all of them, but through all of them. The wicked are going to be judged. The righteous are going to be preserved. And why does he have all of these callbacks, if you want to call them that? All of these echoes, sometimes quotations from the Old Testament. Why does he delve so deeply into this background of the Old Testament in writing the book of Revelation? Well, I think his purpose in doing that is this. He says, remember Sodom and Gomorrah and the things that happened there? Remember the plagues of Egypt and the things that happened there? Do you remember Jericho? Do you remember the fall of idolatrous Samaria and later Jerusalem? Do you remember the fall of Babylon? Do you remember those people who were oppressed in the days of Zechariah? All of those things are referenced in the book of Revelation. Why? In every single instance, God was telling his people, I'm going to judge the wicked and I'm going to preserve the righteous through these trials. And over and over and over and over, we have these examples of God doing just that. And now for us today, we can add to that list of examples the book of Revelation. God's going to judge the wicked, and he's going to preserve the righteous through trials. And that's important for us, because God's still going to do that. And that should provide encouragement for us. However dark the night seems now, we need to remember that it's been dark before, and God has always judged the wicked, and he has always delivered the righteous through the trials. Now, they may be martyred on the way there, but eventually they are going to be redeemed by God. And then finally, number three, I would suggest it's not a matter of, is God on my side? I think that's the question lots of people ask in religion. Is God with me on this? For God's people, we need to be reminded that we must be on his side, on God's side. As David put much more succinctly than I'm about to, the theme of Revelation is the Lord is going to win. And if we're on his side, we're going to win too. And so these Christians would have been tempted to ask, is Jesus really in control? And if so, why are these things happening? Why are we suffering? Why are we persecuted? Is God really in control? Is he really looking out for us? And the book of Revelation answers all of those questions. Yes. God is there. God is in control. And God is looking out for his people. Now, there's a handout that was on the table as you went in. And what I've done here is we're going to add to this as we go through this quarter. An expanded outline of the book of Revelation from what I gave you last quarter. And let's just go through this quickly. I think at this point we probably have a pretty good grasp of what's happening here in these beginning chapters. Chapter 1, Jesus is God. That's the way he is presented there. Chapters 2 and 3 with the letters to the seven churches. Jesus sees us, he knows us, and he commands us to do his will. By him, we are going to overcome. In chapters 4 and 5, God is still on his throne. He is still in control, and the Lamb is the one who is worthy to open the scrolls and to reveal God's will. And the rest of the book is going to prove this. And so, chapters 6 through 11, it is the seven seals, which reaffirm the worthiness of Christ, that he does reign. God is still in control, and he really is sitting on his throne, and he really does have all authority, and God sends forth his forces, whoever and whatever they may be, against the wicked. And at the same time, he seals, preserves, and redeems his righteous people. And yes, he even allows his people to be martyred, but not without victory. And it comes in the form of these cascading visions that we see here. The seven seals that we've already talked about, which give way to the seven trumpets that we are in the midst of. And then the last three of those trumpets are described as the three woes. And that's where we find ourselves there, beginning in verse 13 of chapter 8. And I looked, and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. So we have these three woes that are coming. And in chapter 9 and 10, we see a picture of the moral and spiritual decay, which is going to bring torment and misery to the souls of men. Sin is the culprit of these things. Satan is behind it. And the partial judgment is a trumpet warning for the people of the world to turn from Satan and sin to God. You know, that's one of the amazing things in the book of Revelation to me. It is one of the most graphic pictures of judgment in all the Bible. I mean, pick your other place. Matthew 24 and 25. If you want to go back to the Old Testament, some of those books. I would stack up Revelation with just about any of them in terms of here's what God's judgment is going to look like. And yet, even in the midst of all of that, you know what you see? A desire from God for these things to turn people to repentance. Even in the midst of all of this, His desire ultimately is for people to repent before it's too late. And the end message is there's a time coming where it is going to be too late. But in the meantime, He still wants people to repent, to turn from Satan and turn to God. Okay, verse 1 of chapter 9. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. So God allows this one who falls from heaven to the earth, I believe this to be Satan, He gives him power. That's what a key is, right? It locks and unlocks. You have this authority. He gives him power over what? What does he say there in verse 9? To him was given the key to what? The bottomless pit. Well, here you go. Here's your new home. It's the bottomless pit, right? You have some power. But it's a power over evil. It's a power over things that are destructive in nature. And this is where Satan is cast when he is finally bound in chapter 20. And so in verse 2, and he opened the bottomless pit. This one with the key, Satan, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. This seems to symbolize the polluting of the world by the evil one. Out of his realm comes this billowing smoke that covers everything, pollutes everything. And he brings moral decay and ruin and death to the world. This darkness is a veil. It's a smoke screen. I'm reminded of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. The God of this age has blinded the minds of the unbelieving that the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ should not dawn on them. Have you ever seen those pictures of smog? You know, we've got smog in the United States, especially at a city at high altitude like Denver. When I was in high school, I remember playing basketball in the rain with some friends in Denver one time. We just got soaked to the bone, and so we laid our clothes out. And, you know, took our showers and so forth. And the next morning when we came back to those clothes, they were all bleached out from the rain. Well, that's kind of scary, isn't it? The kind of things that you're taking on you without even knowing it. But our pollution is nothing compared to other parts of the world. You think about places in India, places in China, where the fog and the pollution mixes into this smog that people have to wear masks everywhere they go. This was taken in Shanghai, I think, just this past year. And here they're walking through this darkness that kind of veils everything, that pollutes everything, and if you're too exposed to it for too long, it causes sickness and ultimately death. May I suggest that's a really good metaphor for what we see that the devil does, right? He just wants to obscure everything. He wants to confuse everything. And he wants us to inhale a bunch of this stuff without even realizing it so that we get sick, so that it leads to our ultimate death. And so this smoke comes up out of this bottomless pit. There is this smoke screen over everything that blinds people to the true light. And out of this smoke comes things that are even worse. Notice verses 3 through 5. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green thing, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And we remember that those people who were of God were sealed in an earlier chapter saying, these people belong to God, right? Well, now those seals are coming in handy. They are not going to be harmed by whatever this is. And they were not given authority to kill them, kill these other people, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. So what two animals are mentioned here so far? Locusts and scorpions, right? We think about locusts and locust plagues. This is a modern picture of a locust plague. It's everywhere, right? And what do these locusts do in a literal locust plague? They destroy what? All the vegetation, all the foliage. They just rip all the leaves off the trees, all the leaves off the plants, all the fruit off the plants. All those things are destroyed by this locust plague. But this locust plague, which is everywhere, that's the idea, right? It's not destroying vegetation. What is it destroying? Flesh. The flesh of whom? Evil men, the people who don't have the seal on their foreheads, right? And we see that these locusts are given power, and power to torment like a scorpion. Locust is a symbol of destruction and judgment in many, many places in the Old Testament. But we think about scorpions. Scorpions are also associated with evil. And the power of scorpions is the power to inflict pain and misery, but not death. We think about Luke chapter 10, verses 17 through 20. You can turn there if you want. I'll also read it so you can hear it. Luke chapter 10, verses 17 through 20. Here are the limited commission. The 72, or the sending out of these 72, they returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I saw Satan falling like lightning from heaven. Maybe kind of like a star falling. Behold, I give you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Well, that symbolism there from our Lord sounds very familiar to what we're reading here in Revelation. So the power of scorpions is associated with the power of whom? The power of Satan, right? The power that Satan has. And the power that Satan has in the lives of men is through his evil influence on them. And it is like this power of scorpions. Scorpions are very common and were very common in Asia Minor. Here are four examples of scorpions that are found in modern-day Turkey, where Asia Minor was. There are actually... This is a rabbit hole I went down, but Stephanie's not in this class, knowing how much time I wasted on scorpions. But she's listening to the recordings. Man, can you take care of that for me, Jeremy? There are at least 15 varieties, different, unique varieties of scorpions in Asia Minor. Basically, anybody in that time would have at some point been stung by a scorpion. Unless you were really old and really weak or really young and really weak, it wasn't going to kill you, but boy, it was going to hurt, right? And so that's exactly what we're going to see with this power here. The devil is going to cause intense pain, but his power is limited, as it always is, as it always has been, as it always will be. It's limited. And the locust's purpose is not to destroy the vegetation, but to destroy these unfaithful people. And yet the people of God are going to be delivered from this particular moral degradation, the evil that comes upon men. I like the way Homer Haley puts it. As the people of God escape certain, if not all, the plagues of Egypt, and when we think about locusts, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Well, two things, the plagues in Egypt, and then Joel, where we see a locust plague in that book. So now the sealed of God escape the deception and delusion that torture those who reject the truth. For the Lord knoweth them that are his, 2 Timothy 2:19, and he knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation. 2 Peter 2 and verse 9. And so in verse 5, and they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. This is a length of time that God knows, but it's not going to be the final torment. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. That's how miserable they are in this state of desiring death, in this state of sin. Someone has well said, how often is the life of a man rendered intolerable because of his sins? And he has recourse to the razor, the rope, the river, or the poison. Not so for these. They are miserable, and yet they have to live on in their misery. These locusts like scorpions, what does that describe? In real terms, what does that describe? 3 letters. Sin. This is what sin does. This is what sin is like. Sin always brings misery. And the image is expanded in verses 7 and 8 that makes it even more clear to me that this is sin. The shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men, and they had hair like women's hair. So you read that. Well, that's not too bad. They had the face of a man and a crown on his head, and it had hair like a woman's hair. So maybe this is even something that we look at and we say, hey, that's not too bad. I can live with that, so on and so forth. But then it says, and their teeth were like lion's teeth, and they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots and many horses running into battle, and they had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men for 5 months. It's kind of like a horror movie. You know, the alien creature who appears harmless or even cute or attractive, and then it kills everyone in its path. That's what this is like. You look, and it's the face of a person, and it's vague, but he has a crown on his head. It's somebody who's royalty. That can't be that bad. And then you see hair like a woman, and you say, okay, that's not too bad. I can deal with whatever this is. And she opens her mouth, and it's lion's teeth. And as she comes closer, you see that there's a tail like a scorpion about to strike you. Again, that's sin. Sin appears attractive. Sin promises happiness and then delivers misery. And yet, even in the midst of the misery and unhappiness and even torment, more people often think that more sin is the answer instead of repentance. We think something that appears attractive and then it turns out different. I don't know why this stuck in my mind. You remember the movie Jurassic Park, the first one? And the guy who was the thief who stole all of the stuff, there is this cute little dinosaur that comes up and he sees it and he says, oh, I'm glad you're not one of your big brothers. That's his exact line from the movie. And then it turns into that. And eats him alive. And maybe that's silly. That's the first thing that came to my mind. That's the way sin is. It comes up to us and we say, it's not so bad. I can see how this is attractive. And then before we know it, we're in its clutches in misery. And people desire death and they can't have it. Use your imagination. What would that be like to see that as John did? You think we would look at sin differently? Here is this creature, and you're deluded into thinking that it is gentle and trustworthy. In reality, it's a war horse that will trample you. It has lion's teeth that will devour you. I'm your friend. I'm harmless, sin says. And then it swiftly causes indescribable pain. We read this description, and it gives off the appearance of indestructibility. And I think people of the world sometimes look at sin in that way. Here it is, it's attractive, and we say, okay, I'll do it. And then we get into it, and the devil says, you're the worst person who has ever lived. God's never going to accept you. You will never overcome this sin. And there's a half-truth in that. On our own, we never will. It seems indestructible. It seems insurmountable. And so we say to ourselves, well, why resist? It's overwhelming. But Christians know better than that, don't we? We have passages like James 4, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Enlist in his army. That's a military term. Be part of God's side, right? Come over to his army. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. All of this that we see, the one from the bottomless pit, all that nonsense, he will flee from us in a spiritual sense if we're on God's side. What about 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13? No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. God is faithful. And he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. Now, this is a promise specifically for Christians. But we look at sin as being this insurmountable force. And the rest of Revelation tells us, no, there's something far, far, far more powerful. That's Christ and him crucified. We must never give up. We must never give in. If God is for us, who can be against us? Thoughts or comments there before we keep reading in this passage? David? I think it should absolutely make us angry. Righteous indignation is an appropriate reaction to sin. But if we aren't on Christ's side, the appropriate reaction to come to Christ. But so often the reaction instead is just to lose all hope. Because you're not going to conquer it. None of us will. Not without Christ. And so in verses 11 and 12, and they had as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. In your margin, maybe you have destruction and destroyer there. The king is the ruler of this world, the sphere of evil, and the devil rules in the sphere of evil. He is the spirit of destruction. He is the destroyer of men. And one of the ways that God punishes evil people is by giving them over to their evil ways. You ever thought about that? The punishment for sin is what? It is often just the consequences of sin. Okay, you want to go off into sin? You want to do things your way? There you go. Go ahead. See what's going to happen to you without God. See how that really is. Evil always has consequences, and those consequences are a form of punishment. And so he says in verse 12, one woe is past. Behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. I don't know about you. I read that, and you get through it, and you say, well, surely the worst is over, right? Are we really going to get worse than what we see with the locusts and the scorpions and being tortured for 5 months and all these sorts of things? Well, he says two more woes are coming. It's going to get worse from here for those who do not know God. And who would want to live in this kind of spiritual reality of torment? And yet many choose it every day. They run swiftly to their own destruction. And our job is to try and show them a better way, to try and give them the light, to cut through all of that darkness, all of that smog of sin, that their eyes may be open. Now, there are going to be many who turn their eyes from the light, who don't want to accept it, sure. But there are those who do want the light and will come to the light if we can show them that there is a better way than the way they're living. Okay, verse 13. Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who has the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. So So God continues to reveal that wickedness is self-destructive, and sin and rebellion against Him is going to bring terrible judgments with this sixth trumpet, which is also our second woe. It's the same story, just another verse. Remember that the trumpet sounds and the judgments are a response from God to what? How did this begin? It began with what? Let's go back. These seven trumpets began back there in chapter 8. When he opened the seventh seal, verse 1, there was a silence in heaven for an hour and a half, that calm before the storm we talked about. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar, and he was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense and the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hands. The angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. There were noises and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. All of this is begun by the prayers of the saints. We know one of those prayers back in chapter 6. They cried out with a loud voice saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" And a white robe was given to each of them, and was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was complete. So the prayers go up, and here is God's response. This is the judgment that is going to come upon the wicked in the earth because of what they have done to the righteous of God. We find this voice coming from where? I heard a voice from where? From the altar. And specifically, what part of the altar? The four horns of the altar. Now, the prayers of the saints are offered there from the altar before God. Now, a voice comes in response to those prayers, and it comes from the horns of the altar. Now, a horn, both in the Bible and throughout ancient culture, a horn was a symbol of what? Of power and of might, right? We think about a big horned animal, and it has power and it has might. And so the horns of the altar that is before God, what horns are mightier than those that are right before God? And here this voice comes from there. The golden altar is personified, and it now speaks forth. And it says what in verse 14? What are they supposed to do? Release the four angels. Now, we've seen four angels on the four corners of the earth already in the book of Revelation. Now, these angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates, these angels are going to be released. The Euphrates River, where was that in relation to Israel? Okay, it was east and what? North. And if you were going to get to the Euphrates River, which way did you have to go, unless you wanted to die of thirst, which way did you go in order to get there from Israel? You had to go due north, right? Here's a map that kind of shows that. In fact, the Euphrates River during the time of Solomon was the northern border. And that was one of the promises that God made, was that this land was going to extend all the way up to the Euphrates. When things were at their height, at their zenith, that's how big this kingdom was. In fact, during the days of Solomon, for a brief period, the kingdom of Israel was the greatest nation on earth. And so we see that it goes all the way up there to the Euphrates River. But that Euphrates was always a border. And north of the Euphrates, once you get up above there, what did you find? That good stuff up there? For the people of God, or the people of Israel, sometimes they weren't really the people of God the way they acted. What came from the north? What came across the Euphrates and down? Conquerors, that's exactly right. Assyria, Babylon, others, right? That's where the conquerors were going to come from. And he's using this in kind of a symbolic way here to talk about these angels have been restrained at the border, but now they're being released. And now they are coming to conquer. God calls on them to come and destroy these people and exercise God's wrath upon them. They've been restrained to this point, but now the time of judgment has come. I want to get to at least verse 16. So let's read verses 15 and 16. So the four angels who have been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. These angels were prepared for this judgment for a fixed time in the mind of God. It was down to the what? Down to the month? Yeah. Down to the day? Yeah. Down to the what? Down to the hour. If you think about it, that's one of the more comforting verses in the book of Revelation. Does God have a plan for all this? What's God going to do about it? And God isn't up there in heaven scrambling around saying, oh, my people are being persecuted. What am I going to do? I got to figure something out. He's had his plan down to the hour when these things are going to take place. When he is going to righteously vindicate his people. Now, we don't know all those plans. We don't know when and how. But God does. And God will vindicate his people. And the judgment is more intense. Before, nobody has died, at least as far as I can tell in these trumpets. A third of each realm is afflicted and tormented, but nobody dies. But now what? What happens now? A third of the people die. And we think about all the power of sin and how it's described and so forth. Well, the number of the army of the horsemen compared, you think about the locusts and you say, oh, that's so many. Well, the army of the horsemen was how many? 200 million. I heard the number of them, he said. Someone has said, they've done the measurements on this. You put 200 million people on horseback and put them in a column. It would be a column 1 mile wide and 85 miles long. That's more like the army of God, isn't it? Bigger than anything that has ever been seen or ever would have been seen, has been seen. Here it comes. And again, we don't need to look to history to say, okay, where was there a literal army that had 200 million people in it? That's not the point. The point is God, at any point, has the power to judge. He has the power to avenge. But he will do so at the time he is appointed, down to the very hour of the time that is right. And we should find great comfort and hope and peace knowing that. All right, here's what I want you to do for next time. Will you read chapters 10 and 11, and that will get us through the end of this section. And so that's our plan for next time. We have a singing next week, so you have a couple of weeks to cover this. But read chapters 10 and 11 for next time, and that's what we'll cover the first Wednesday that we are back together. Thank you for your good attention tonight.